Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 16 is brought to you by WAG and Audible. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
If you haven't figured it out by now, Amelia and Justine have spent nearly a year doing an incredibly exhaustive investigation of what happened to Freddie Gray. They know every second of the CCTV footage, every detail of every dispatch call, every document ever released to the public or made available to them through dozens and dozens of public information requests that they filed. And because they knew so much, they knew something wasn't adding up. It wasn't just paranoia. And it was stronger than intuition. And in the end, they were proven right when a new batch of documents gave proof that evidence in this case had been tampered with. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, the final episode. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm here as always with my colleagues, Dr. Marsha Chatlin, Amelia McDonald-Perry, and Justine Barron.
My name is Amelia McDonald-Perry, and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marsha Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
When Alabama Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III was nominated to the position of Attorney General of the United States, he ensured that his confirmation hearing would foreshadow his top priorities if confirmed. After introducing his wife, his children, and his 10 grandchildren, he decided to add,
"Finally, I want to express how humbled I am to have received such overwhelming support and encouragement from our nation's law enforcement community. Many are here today. Every major law enforcement organization in America has endorsed my candidacy. I feel the weight of the confidence they placed in me. And gentlemen and ladies, I'll do my best to be worthy of that."
Since Sessions was named Attorney General, he has moved swiftly and aggressively to hold to his word in this area. After being sworn into office on February 9, 2017, Sessions has been dogged in reversing the initiatives started and overseen by his two predecessors, Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch, who were not radical in their approach to police reform, but were willing to deploy Department of Justice resources to research and address police abuse. Less than 2 months after he moved into his new role at the Department of Justice, Sessions drafted a memo to DOJ department heads and U.S. attorneys. After acknowledging that the safety and protection of the public is the paramount concern and duty of law enforcement officials, and local law enforcement must protect and respect the civil rights of all members of the public, Sessions got to the heart of the memo when he directed, quote, "The Deputy Attorney General and the Associate Attorney General are hereby directed to immediately review all department activities, including collaborative investigations and prosecutions, grant making, technical assistance and training, compliance reviews, existing or contemplated consent decrees, and task force participation in order to ensure that they fully and effectively promote the principles outlined above." Among the principles outlined in the memo was the idea that, quote, "local control and local accountability are necessary for effective local policing. It is not the responsibility of the federal government to manage non-federal law enforcement agencies." At first glance, this may sound like Sessions was just making a statement about federalism. But when you consider the role the previous DOJ leaders took in investigating the Ferguson, Chicago, and Baltimore police departments after the killing of unarmed civilians in all the cities, and even a torture scandal in Chicago, why would Sessions make a point to say that the federal government should leave policing to the locals? Despite his own career in Congress and his seat in a presidential cabinet, Sessions' position draws from a long history of using states' rights rhetoric to resist and deflect Supreme Court rulings, executive orders, and other federal mandates. The rhetoric of states' rights arguments are as old as the Republic, and from debates about what would be in the U.S. Constitution, the battle over slavery, the use of federal troops to enforce school desegregation, the passage of legislation to prevent voter intimidation, and on and on. So the idea of states' rights and its good buddy local control is reason for concern for any and all concerned about civil rights. Within 3 days of releasing the memo, the DOJ requested a 90-day delay in the implementation and enforcement of the consent decree, the agreement between the feds and Baltimore police to end racially biased practices, implement better training for officers, and address the policing culture that not only led to millions of dollars in BPD payouts, but also contributed to Freddie's death. That was agreed upon between President Obama's DOJ and the Baltimore Police Department only 8 days before Trump's inauguration. The DOJ motion filed in the U.S. District Court for Maryland tried to make the case that because the new administration had prioritized, quote, combating and preventing violent crime in response to alarming spikes in violent crime in cities across the country, including Baltimore, and that the new president found that a focus on law and order and the safety and security of the American people requires commitment to enforcing the law and developing policies that comprehensively address illegal immigration, drug trafficking, and violent crime, that an effort like the consent decree had to be reviewed. More importantly, the motion suggested that the Baltimore Police Department had already done a lot of reform. The department, all by itself, and the city of Baltimore had made progress towards reform on its own. And as a consequence, it may be possible to take these changes into account where appropriate to ensure future compliance while protecting public safety. Earlier, the DOJ was granted a request to delay the first hearings on police reform and the decree, but this motion asked for more time to see what it could amend and change. The April motion not only takes its cues from the states' rights playbook, but it also confuses the issue of police reform and police efficiency. The notion that respecting civil rights, ending police brutality, and protecting whistleblowers is antithetical to reducing crime or protecting citizens is a dangerous one. And when it's advanced by the Department of Justice, the hope for reform becomes more elusive. As could be expected, the Fraternal Order of Police supported the motion, saying that the FOP were not consulted about the decree and that they wanted to be able to tell Trump what was really going on. Mayor Catherine Pugh and Police Commissioner Kevin Davis disagreed, distancing themselves from the motion and saying that any delay would imperil their attempts at meaningful reform.
This morning we had many conversations last night about the Department of Justice decision to seek a 90-day extension. You probably first saw the mayor's statement and then our statement, and our view remains the same. We are ready to roll with the consent decree. As you all know, we stood up a team, a Department of Justice compliance and accountability team, to work with the Department of Justice when they initiated their investigation. And that's unheard of in our business. We cooperated fully with the Department of Justice during the course of their investigation. And I argue that one of the many reasons why their report was so lengthy, so inclusive, was because they received the full cooperation from the Baltimore Police Department. We know we have to get better. We know that over many, many years, things have occurred here that prevent the men and women of the Baltimore Police Department from being the best that they can be. And as a reminder, we accelerated by...
So the city filed its own motion. Judge James Craig Bredar agreed, denied the request for the delay, and signed the consent decree. In his memorandum and order, he noted, quote, Surely no one can project a perfect solution for all that ails the city of Baltimore and the fraught relationship between its citizens and its police department. The larger point at this juncture is that there has been an investigation. There has been a lengthy negotiation between the parties conducted by skilled and experienced counsel. And that negotiation has yielded a detailed and seemingly reasonable agreement that all parties have signed. There is no suggestion that when counsel for the parties signed their agreement, that they did not have the full and complete authority to bind their clients to its terms. The time for expressing, quote, grave concern has passed, and instead the parties must now execute the agreement as they promised they would. So on April 7th, 2017, the city of Baltimore had trumped a 76-day-old administration, perhaps irritated an attorney general with less than 2 months on the job, but more importantly, they now had to do the hardest thing, transform a 233-year-old police department. According to the Washington Post database on police shootings, since May 1st, 2015, the day that state's attorney Marilyn Mosby announced the charges in the Freddie Gray killing, no less than 2,072 people have been killed by police in the United States.
Listeners, it's Amelia. And if we're friends or you follow me on Twitter or Instagram or happen to live in the apartment next door, then you know that I am obsessed with my dog, Luca. I rescued her as a puppy and we've been almost inseparable for the last 11 years. Luca and I do almost everything together. We sit on the fire escape and squirrel watch. We take long walks around Brooklyn and she's always down to watch a little CCTV footage. While I'm lucky enough to work from home and bring Luca out and about with me on errands, there are definitely occasions that don't allow for four-legged plus ones. And whenever I need a dog walker, I rely on Wag. Wag is an on-demand app for getting a dog walker. It's kind of like calling an Uber, only Wag sends a person who will take your pooch for a stroll and make sure they do their business. All of Wag's walkers are thoroughly vetted, so you get quality people who are experienced with dogs. The app makes the whole process super easy and interactive. You'll get a notification when the walk is started, and you can follow them on their journey thanks to the app's GPS technology. You can even see exactly where your dog peed and pooped. I've noticed that Luca likes to mix things up when I'm not around. Wag will even send you a free lockbox for storing a spare set of keys. Wag is really a must-have app for every dog owner, and you can get your first Wag walk free by texting undisclosed to 25324. Text UNDISCLOSED to 25324, and Wag will send you a special link to download the app and get your first dog walk absolutely free.
For the last year, our investigation has had a few dangling threads that it seemed could possibly unravel the entire cover-up around the death of Freddie Gray, if we just had a little more information. We've gotten more information, and the threads have gotten much, much longer. Let's revisit that knife. At one point, the knife allegedly found on Freddie Gray was provided as the reason for his arrest. In their taped interviews on the day of the arrest, officers Garrett Miller and Edward Nero said that once they restrained Gray on the ground, he requested an inhaler. They sat him up and Nero searched him, discovering the knife. Nero set it down, they both said, but then Gray motioned towards it. This led to Miller turning him over and restraining him for their protection, they said. Soon after, Miller is heard on the dispatch audio played at trial, asking for a complaint number, or a CC number, to charge Gray with possession of a concealed deadly weapon. That's a Maryland state law. Actually, it's called the Dangerous Weapon Statute, and it does restrict switchblades. Then, at 11:40 p.m. that night, according to documents, Miller submitted an application for charges that told a kind of a different story. He wrote, "The defendant was apprehended in the 1700 block of Presbury. The officer noticed a knife clipped to the inside of his front right pants pocket. The defendant was arrested without force or incident." Gray was charged with illegal possession of a switchblade, a Baltimore City law. In this story, the knife was not concealed, but clipped to his pocket and visible. It was not discovered in the course of a very long, invasive, and handcuffed pat-down, but it was noticed from the outside. The state's attorney's office, or SAO, went with the version told in Miller and Nero's taped interviews. The officers restrained Gray for too long before they knew if he had committed a crime, they argued. Because SAO felt the arrest happened before the knife was discovered, they conceded to a defense motion to preclude discussion of the knife's legality from the trials, even though they knew it was a legal knife, an assisted opener, not a switchblade. There may be no issue that we have raised in this entire podcast that has been disputed more than our claim that the knife in question was legal. And we've argued against the cause and manner of Freddie Gray's death as reported, but Baltimore police, and Baltimore police only, continue to argue on social media that assisted opener knives, which require manual force before a spring-like device opens them the rest of the way, are switchblades or qualify as switchblades under Baltimore's law. This despite historical, legal, and technical evidence to the contrary. At the same time, these officers will argue that the knife doesn't matter in this case. Cops don't need to have perfect reasons to arrest people. That isn't wrong. The Supreme Court has allowed cops to make errors in judgment about the law. So the knife is a non-issue. All sides seem to argue. Yeah, we don't know. Just for the sake of it, let's follow this non-important knife through the rest of the day of Freddie Gray's arrest and see where it takes us. In the long version of Kevin Moore's video of Freddie Gray's arrest, which was not shared with the public, we see Officer Miller pick up Gray's knife and phone as Gray is loaded into the van. At the van door, he appears to look for a place to put them, then he hands them over to Officer Goodson. It's not 100% clear that the knife in the video is the same knife that was released to media after the trials ended. That knife was blue and black. The one in the video appears to just be black. Then again, it does seem to have a glass impactor button, which is a feature of the rescue-style knife that was released to media, so it's hard to tell. Anyway, the knife was transferred from Miller to Goodson's possession with Freddie Gray's phone. Then that night, around 9 p.m., according to documents, Officer Miller appears to have turned the knife into Evidence Control Unit, or ECU. Novak filled out a property sheet with his submission. He filed the knife under an injured person case with the same CC number as the Force Investigations team's investigation into Gray's injury. So not with the CC number that was provided over dispatch that morning when he called in the knife charge. This is how CC numbers work. One CC number is supposed to be used for all related cases. The other ones are no longer used. There is no accounting for the knife during all of those hours between the arrest and the 9 p.m. submission. That's about 12 hours. And here's the other rub. The knife was given to Goodson with Freddie's phone. But Freddie's phone took an entirely different journey that day. It was turned in by Officer William Porter. Now, let's follow the phone's journey. Porter spent most of the day of April 12th at Shock Trauma on prisoner watch. He followed the ambulance to the hospital from the Western District around 10 a.m. Just after 4 p.m., he was relieved by another officer, stopped briefly at the Western District, and then headed to headquarters. He stopped briefly at the homicide offices where the force investigation team and many of the officers were. Then he went down to the evidence control unit where he turned in the following, according to documents. Freddie's clothing, his earbuds, his cell phone, state ID, and $5 in currency. Porter wrote up a supplemental report with all of the evidence he submitted to ECU, which is required by a general order. He submitted this evidence under the original CC number from that morning, according to the documents, so not from the injured person charge. The whole rest of the case continued to be submitted under the injured person CC number, the one for the investigation, except for Freddie Gray's personal belongings. Maybe this seems like a careless mistake. Maybe. Keep listening. The question is, how did the phone and the knife become separated? At some point in his journey, Porter was given the phone to turn in, with everything else belonging to Gray, but not the knife. Where did the knife go? Freddie's clothes and his earbuds are easy. They came from the hospital to ECU. The phone and knife are less clear. There's no good reason Porter didn't submit all of it together under one CC number. Paul Gianelli, professor of law, wrote seminal articles in the 1990s on best practices in the collection and maintenance of evidence. Quote, when a chain of custody is required, he writes, either to show the identity of the item or its unchanged condition, it is necessary to determine where the chain begins and ends. Only breaks in possession that occur within the period included in the chain of custody affect admissibility. For example, he writes, if a third party finds a rifle near a crime scene and turns it over to police several hours or days after the crime, it would be necessary to account for the rifle during the time it was in the third party's possession. Some courts, he adds, have indicated that all the links in the chain of custody must testify at trial. He also adds that this doesn't necessarily apply to minor links, like police officers. But keep in mind, the police officers in this case are witnesses. Actually, they shouldn't have been handling evidence in the first place. Joseph Jackalone, a criminal justice professor and retired NYPD detective, discussed how evidence custody is maintained in New York, a department that, for all of its flaws, is regarded today as a very successful bureaucracy.
So when you're dealing with any type of evidence, you always have to be concerned about chain of custody, or you might even call chain of evidence. It means the same thing. And the chain just means that there's links in it. And then the link is each person that comes in contact with the evidence that you have. So if you're dealing with a firearm, so if the officer at the scene, let's say a uniform officer makes an arrest and the guy has an illegal firearm, that officer becomes the first link in the chain. Now, what you try to do is minimize handling. So even if the officer has it, he or she is going to try to minimize that, you know, handling, because we don't want to try to destroy any latent prints or any even touch DNA tests. So you want to try to have as few links as possible. So when you have a death in custody, or you have, let's say, a homicide or something like that, when a gun is recovered, that gun will be left there. It's actually Latin called in situ, I-N-S-I-T-U, which just means in place. You leave all evidence in place until it can be photographed with a ruler, and then taken into custody. So, for instance, in a situation like that where a gun is left out at a crime scene, our crime scene unit personnel will collect the handgun just to make sure that it's collected properly, that we don't ruin or destroy any other evidence. And they actually become the first link in the chain. So now they then, after they are done collecting it and doing whatever they need to do and packaging it, they hand it off to the case investigator. So whatever detective is catching the case, he or she gets it and now becomes chain link number two in the chain of custody. That detective then goes back and vouches the gun. And when that gets sent down to the lab, that lab person now become number three. So it's just an extra layer of, people handling it when it happens at a crime scene, per se, because you don't want to disturb crime scenes. That's why we have our crime scene personnel take care of it at that point. This way, we can testify in court that every piece of evidence that was found at this crime scene was collected and secured and packaged by members of the crime scene unit. We don't have other people putting their hands in the cookie jar, so to speak, because that only then creates a laundry list of problems for you.
NYPD's patrol guide has 135 pages on property management. BPD's policy, control of property and evidence, is 22 pages long. That's longish for BPD, but it's really not that demanding. And it leaves the chain of custody before evidence is submitted to ECU vague. Our sources confirm there is very little attention paid to how evidence gets to ECU. The rules are lax. It is not surprising that Baltimore has had incidents of cops getting away with planting guns for years, including some of the officers recently indicted by the federal government. Here's what we know. There is one evidence control unit log for the Freddie Gray investigation with one CC number, but Freddie Gray's personal belongings were kept off of it for the entirety of the investigation. I made a request to BPD to see if they could provide the ECU log for that other CC number, the one with his belongings. I was told that it was submitted in error. No such ECU log existed, but we see a receipt for the submission under that CC number. It's in the investigative files. Well, we see a copy of a handwritten receipt with a signature, supposedly from ECU, that really seems to have been entered later onto a copy. What I mean is Porter's original writing is in faded, broken ink. The ECU signature is dark and clear. In other words, where are Freddie Gray's belongings? The knife wasn't the only evidence that wasn't properly managed or investigated. Just after Gray was sent to the hospital, the van, the crime scene itself, was put back into service. Goodson's run sheet indicated that he took the van to get gas. That's what he wrote. It was only called back by someone from the force investigation team. And then the crime scene tech was only instructed to take pictures, not collect any evidence from it. At least one officer, Lieutenant Rice, with almost two decades on the force, should have known to keep the van on the scene. He knew enough to call for a crime scene unit. So, recap. What's left out of evidence on day one? Gray's clothing and any evidence of fingerprints or blood from the van. And what disappeared and reappeared? The knife.
It's summertime, so I'm out of the classroom for a while, and I love spending my summer break learning, and it's easier to do with Audible. Audible provides an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from the leading publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and publications. It's perfect for road trips, long flights, walks in the woods, or those precious moments of quiet you get before your kids wake up and beg you to take them to the pool. With an Audible subscription, you have access to the world's largest collection of audiobooks. We're talking more than 180,000 titles. And with the Audible app, you have access to special channels providing unique content, updated regularly, and exclusive to Audible listeners. With the app, you can pick out clips of the book you're reading and share them with friends, control the speed of the book's narration, and you can even switch between the spoken word and the written word with the app's special Whisper Sync for Voice feature. If you have an iPhone, Android device, Fire tablet, iPod, or other MP3 player, then you are ready to join Audible. Audible is offering undisclosed listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title for free and start listening. It's that easy. I already have my Audible summer list picked out, and I think you'll want to check out these titles too. I can't wait to listen to Herb Boyd's Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. If you want to learn more about Baltimore, then you can listen to The Boys of Dunbar, A Story of Love, Hope, and Basketball by Alejandro Danos. If you enjoyed Wesley Lowery on our addendum, then you can listen to his new book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. And if you want to learn more about some of the issues we talked on the podcast, then you definitely want to listen to Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. So just go to audible.com/undisclosed, that's audible.com/undisclosed, and get started today.
The crime scene unit did take two more sets of important pictures that day. The crime scene tech went to the hospital and took pictures of Freddie Gray in his hospital bed. And then down at headquarters, she took pictures of the officers and their tasers. The pictures showed the officers from a distance and close up, including close-ups of their hands. The back of Officer Miller's hands were red, maybe bruised or inflamed. Not red all over, but definitively red on the knuckles and two finger joints. There's nothing said about this in any of the files. If you ball your hand and fist and punch something, you might get red marks in just that pattern, at least according to numerous online image searches. The knuckles and middle joints would make contact, and the top joints would be gripping tightly. Now, these pictures weren't taken, apparently, until 1:20 p.m., many hours after Miller would have interacted with Gray. There are other possibilities for what caused the red hands. When hands have an allergic or eczemic reaction, they can turn red in the exact same pattern, which has something to do with the vulnerability of the skin around joints. The hands could have turned red as a result of wearing latex gloves, say, which cops actually do when handling evidence. If so, those gloves would have needed to be turned in also. There weren't any gloves turned in. Or maybe Miller just banged his hands on a door. Who knows? Someone should have made a note about the redness and investigated it. It's obvious. Otherwise, what is the point of the pictures? We're not quite done with that knife. The day after Freddie Gray's death on April 20th, the police released documents showing that he had been arrested on April 12th at 11:40 p.m. for possession of a switchblade. The document is known as the Application for Statement of Charges filled out by Miller. They waited until Gray died to release it. These documents, also called charging documents, are submitted to a court commissioner who signs and formally charges prisoners. Officers have 24 hours in Maryland after an arrest to complete this process. Within the genre of charging documents, the Freddie Gray documents are thin on detail. The narrative is only 5 sentences. In addition to the part described before about the spring-assisted knife clipped to the inside pocket, it says, "During transport to Western District via wagon transport, the defendant suffered a medical emergency and immediately was transported to shock trauma via a medic." So, if you read other charging documents, even those by Miller, they usually include detailed step-by-step accounts. The point is to make a case for probable cause. Here's an excerpt from a typical narrative by Miller. Quote, "On 7/27/14, at approximately 3 p.m., P.O. Lane received a call via KGA of gambling in the 2800 block of West Lanville Street. An anonymous caller reported several males were in the block playing dice for money. This area has received numerous complaints of illegal dice games. P.O. Lane has personally observed this activity and warned individuals on previous occasions. Officers Nero, Miller, Lopez, and Lane arrived in the block in marked patrol cars and in uniform and observed a large group of black males actively engaged in a dice game. Upon noticing our marked patrol vehicles," and so on. This narrative goes on for another page and a half and includes a long list of evidence seized. The level of detail is usually this comprehensive. Some of these case files read like gripping short stories of lovers and neighbors fighting over money, clothing, or promises. "I told her to just let it go already. She never does." That's someone quoted in one of Porter's case files. If the Freddie Gray charging documents had been more typical, they would have included the names of all of the officers on the scene. They would have included the time of the incident. I've never seen the time missing. They would have listed the other stops. They would have mentioned bringing the knife to ECU. They would have said who arrested Gray. Instead, Miller wrote, "The defendant was arrested," in passive voice. Later in the case file, Miller crossed out arresting under his name, leaving just officer. There seems to have been a lot of risk reduction going on. I've heard more than one person describe these documents as CYA or cover your ass paperwork. This is an extraordinarily common term in Baltimore criminal justice. Miller and the other officers realized that they had a near-dead prisoner, the theory goes, and needed to justify why he was put into the van in the first place. They did so sloppily. Freddie Gray's charging documents are also unusual in that they are written by hand. Most of the time, cops type the forms into one of the district's processing computers. There are some exceptions, including for warrants and summons. Freddie Gray's arrest was a summons. In another document, he is ordered to appear in court on the 22nd at 1:30 p.m. Actually, policy dictates that Miller should have arranged a bedside commission for Gray instead of filing a summons. This would have involved calling a commissioner to meet him at the hospital. I don't think Miller knew about this policy. Most people don't. But if he did, he might have realized that calling a commissioner to charge a dying man with a switchblade, that wouldn't have gone well. There are all kinds of other oddities within these documents and the entire Freddie Gray case file. Charging documents have a box in the upper left of each page. It is filled in with the courthouse location. It is blank on the Freddie Gray charging documents. In the 55 charging documents I have in our files, I've never seen it blank. Usually this box is typed in or filled out by hand by the court commissioner. In one case, I have seen it filled out by an officer, Miller, actually. So maybe this is just more proof that this was lazy CYA work. Maybe it's something else. There's a whole other issue with signatures on these documents and elsewhere. Miller didn't sign his name on these forms in the way that he usually does. Normally, he signs a tight GM. His signature here, it's loose and it extends outward and upward. I do think that it is Garrett Miller's signature. It has the same basic old-fashioned cursive G. I've seen him sign like this just once before, but I wasn't the only one concerned. Just after the trials ended, the defense team released another set of charging documents for switchblade arrests to media. It included one arrest by Miller of a man named Polk. So the idea was to show that these kinds of charges are normal and that SAO has approved them. But over Miller's signature, his trademark tight cursive GM, someone signed a big black squiggle line. From a distance, it looks like his signature on the Freddie Gray charting documents more than the GM. You have to look really closely to see his original signature under it. It's possible that someone was worried that Miller's signature wasn't consistent before they sent it out to media. I also pulled the case file for the Polk arrest at the courthouse. It also has a black squiggle line over Miller's signature, but it's a different squiggle line. They did the same thing in two different places. I've seen initials next to cop signatures. I've never seen anything like this. More signatures. The Freddie Gray charging documents are signed by a court commissioner in a few places. This is another loose kind of squiggle line. It doesn't look like a name. It's not entirely the same in all three places. It looks like maybe a J and then a broken curved line, also outwards and upwards. I made a catalog of every single commissioner's signature on all of the charging documents I had in my possession. I never saw one that looked this formless. Some look messy or are like barely readable names, but they still look like names. They still have some distinction. I called the commissioner's office and I asked what was the name of the commissioner on the Freddie Gray charging documents based on the ID number provided. The administrator said the number belonged to a Ricky Parker. I really struggle to see a Ricky Parker signing his name like that. If I sound like a nutty conspiracy theorist, I am not alone. In a defense motion, it is mentioned that the prosecution was looking into charging Officer Miller with perjury related to these documents. Or, at least, the concept of perjury appeared twice in their notes. They didn't go through with it. These are hardly even the only suspicious signatures that we found around this case. A similar dark, squiggle line signature that is written on top of Garrett Miller, shows up on two arrests on April 12th, the same day Gray was arrested, including one by Mark Gladhill, a witness in the case. It has the exact same shape on two different arrests by two different officers on the same day. Okay. When the defense team filed a motion to preclude mention of the knife in court, they attached a bunch of charging documents for switchblade arrests in the year before. It's so obvious that many of the commissioner's signatures are signed by the same person, but then they use different ID numbers. And then again, more of the officer's signatures are just these squiggle lines. I can't tell if they're just filling in a blank or lying. We'll post these to the website so you can see for yourself. I am really curious if this is a thing in Baltimore. Going back to the Freddie Gray charging documents, they appeared in media and they appeared in the case files and the investigative files, yet I can't locate the original. I was told again and again to check the case file. But in the case file, in the courthouse, I just saw a copy. That was the first time I looked, on December 27th. A couple of months later, the case file was a little bit fuller. Now, there is the pink carbon triplicate copy of the charging documents. Hardly readable. But still, no original. Where are those original documents? So what does this all mean? Well, one question that comes to mind is, did Officer Miller actually go before the court commissioner on April 12, 2015 to charge Freddie Gray with switchblade possession? We didn't learn about this charge or the existence of these charging documents until right after Gray died. Actually, what we heard during the week that he was still alive was this.
He has not been charged yet.
That's Deputy Commissioner Rodriguez. He repeated this again in the press conference. He sounded very sure during an otherwise very tentative press conference. But Gray was supposedly charged the night before. So either Rodriguez was lying because he knew that the switchblade charge wasn't a good one, or maybe nobody told him, or maybe he wasn't lying. Maybe those charges hadn't been filed. Not only wasn't the knife announced publicly until the 20th, after Freddie Gray died, it wasn't photographed until the 20th. It wasn't turned in with the rest of the evidence by Porter. There's no supplemental report describing it. The arrest was filed under a different spelling of Gray's name. Media wouldn't have found it that first week. For sure, there was some funny business with the knife, because the ECU log shows that Officer Novak had the knife in his possession on April 27th, 2 weeks later, when he was supposed to be on leave and not as a witness involved in the investigation at all. Novak somehow, according to the log, turned it into ECU without checking it out first. So let's not pretend that ECU is some kind of a fail-proof evidence system. In trying to figure out if the knife charge was filed as stated on April 12th, I looked at tracking numbers. Individual charges are given tracking numbers which indicate around what date they were filed. The tracking numbers for warrants and summons are on a different sequence. So I put together a database of about 50 warrants and summons during a 3-month period around Gray's arrest. Around 85% of them are in some kind of an order. Not an exact order, but they seem relatively sequential. About 15% jump out of order completely. This includes Freddie Gray's knife arrest. If I put the charges where they belong, they would fall about 5 or 6 days later. The possibility that Miller's charging documents were backdated, or that the knife charge wasn't decided until later, this is a theory, it's a supposition, of course. The point is that the tracking numbers don't rule it out. Yes, it could all just be CYA. As one retired homicide detective told me, quote, "I can't tell you how much stupidity, arrogance, and incompetence affects policing. Outsiders see conspiracies, and I see a colossal clusterfuck." Yeah, that was our theory for a while. This was just sloppiness. That was before we received all of the dispatch reports. Then the thread in this case really came undone.
Over the last 11 episodes, we've played or dictated the calls made between the officers in this case and dispatch, some of them multiple times. The trial exhibit version supposedly encompasses all of the police radio activity pertaining to Freddie Gray. It starts with the foot chase on North Avenue and ends with Lieutenant Rice's request for a crime lab, documenting 5 out of the 6 stops in between. Investigators would have had access to the audio, as well as the digital dispatch records, almost immediately, so we didn't buy it when they made the timeline and van's route seem like a big old mystery. That changed, of course, just as soon as Freddie was dead, and then suddenly, they had almost all the answers. BPD and the Baltimore City Fire Department, like many other agencies, each use a computer automated dispatch system, or CAD system, to document pretty much every single incident involving emergency personnel or patrol officers. Amongst the police investigation files are multiple CAD reports that are supposed to provide a timeline for the events that morning, according to what information was conveyed to the dispatcher. There are 6 CAD numbers associated with the case, 7 if you count the one affiliated with Dante Allen's drug arrest. A lot of these CAD reports were indeed printed out on April 12th, though I did take note of those printed out on April 20th. But it seems our contention that dispatch was being used at the earliest stages of the investigation was correct. I've spent countless hours now listening to live and archived BPD radio traffic from a public scanner, including everything that was picked up on April 12, 2015. There are a handful of Western District calls, at most, that made the scanner that day. This could be suspicious, or this could just be the fact that scanner radios are imperfect and they have signal problems. Most of what the scanner was able to pick up on April 12th is dominated by the Northern, Northwest, Eastern, and Central District channels. So Western isn't the only channel that was kind of quiet. Anyway, I've gotten somewhat better at understanding shorthand used by cops and dispatchers, but CAD reports are their own beast to interpret. There are lots and lots and lots of numbers and not nearly as many words, at least the way BPD does it. There also isn't a universal database of codes and acronyms. Far from it, actually. Every police or fire agency does things a bit differently, though there are some similar terms and descriptors. But there also just isn't so much transparency, period. I know, it's very surprising. Anyway, in addition to poring over these reports day after day, I also asked a real police dispatcher for help. She was kind enough to give me hours of her time, but asked to remain anonymous, so I'm just going to call her by a pseudonym, Mary. Quote, "I found these problematic for multiple reasons," Mary said. "You should be able to read these reports and know what happened, when it happened, and everyone who was there. These tell you almost nothing." While the reports corroborate a sort of vaguely drawn sketch of the official timeline, the details are full of discrepancies and glaring holes. There is just so much missing. I was actually kind of stupefied by it. All of the reports contain the bare minimum of details. Timestamps, locations, the occasional officer name and unit number, but no information about the incident itself. Mary was seriously flabbergasted by this. Her agency is smaller than BPD, and they have less crime to deal with, but she still felt like these dispatch records fail to perform their very basic function, documenting all of the basic actions taken by all of the officers during an incident. Quote, "Our reports are like novels," she said. And seriously, they are. After redacting all of the names and addresses, Mary sent along a few examples of CAD reports produced by her agency. The shortest report was 15 pages long, listed every officer dispatched to the scene, when they got there, when they left, and everything important that occurred while they were there. Meanwhile, the longest BPD CAD report in the bunch is 3 pages, and that third page only has 1 line of text on it. Pieced together, the CAD reports in BPD's investigatory files tell a story, but it's not a complete one populated with all the locations and people heard on the dispatch audio. Plus, some of the timing is just weird. Remember, many of the significant benchmarks on the official timeline align with calls on the dispatch audio, like the "We got one," which is signified Freddie had been apprehended. But a lot of those audio dispatches are not reflected in the CAD reports. To be very clear, not everything said on the audio would be on these reports. It's not a transcription. But the officer's whereabouts and activity are supposed to be accounted for. And there is so much that's missing, that doesn't add up, that just does not match. Here's just one example. Officer Garrett Miller, who arrested and charged Freddie Gray for possession of a switchblade knife, who requested a CC number at stop 2, and was present at 3 out of the 6 stops, remember him? He is nowhere to be found on any of the CAD reports in BPD's binders. If you were to look at these reports and make a list of all the involved officers, Miller would not be on it. neither would Ricardo Alvarado, Aaron Jackson, or Alicia White, because they don't appear on any of the CAD reports in the files either. What's worse is that this seems to have bothered no one. It bothered me. I knew there either had to be additional CAD reports that were left out of the binders that would fill these holes, or there really was no digital dispatch evidence to support a lot of what's heard on the audio. So I've been filing individual MPIA requests with the Baltimore Police Department. I've been asking and paying for, at $10 a pop, additional CAD reports that might account for the other officers' whereabouts or the other locations referenced on the dispatched audio on April 12, 2015. Anybody can do this, by the way. To start, I looked through Open Baltimore's list of 911 calls for April 12, 2015, and picked out 10 in the Western District from that morning. I filed MPIA requests for their corresponding CAD reports, and also call for service unit reports for every Western District Patrol officer who was working that morning. These unit reports list all of the calls that particular officer responded to that day. There are just one of these reports in BPD's files, for Officer Goodson. Okay, so heads up, I'm going to refer to each related CAD report by its last three digits, and you'll be able to find them all on our website. But don't be surprised if they're confusing when you look at them. It took me months to grasp it. The first or earliest CAD report in BPD's files is number 685. While you might expect it to encompass the foot chase, Freddie's detainment, and arrest at stop one, it's actually associated with Lieutenant Rice's backup call to 1707 North Mount Street. There is no record on the CAD reports in the files of anything heard on the dispatch audio during the 2 minutes prior to Rice's backup call, including Rice's foot chase. We can play a portion for you, but even more was on the dispatch audio played at trial, and none of it is accounted for on a CAD report.
North Avenue and 109.
Mount.
North and Mount. Anybody in the area?
According to Mary, my dispatcher source, if the foot chase happened the way the dispatch audio suggests, there should be evidence of it on a CAD report somewhere. Quote, "That should be a call, absolutely. A foot chase is the most dangerous of all chases for police officers," Mary said. "I need to know where you're at, how many of you there are, and there should be no other radio traffic until that foot pursuit ends. If you call a foot pursuit, you get a CAD number." And if Rice told dispatch he was involved in a foot chase on North Avenue and Mount, he would be on an affiliated CAD report. But according to Rice's unit report for that day, and that documents every call he responded to, 1707 North Mount was his first documented call that morning. Rice is the primary officer on CAD number 685, and officers Gladhill, Nero, and Goodson are listed as backup officers, in that order. Except Nero was never at 1707 North Mount Street, because he, as he clearly told dispatch, was at 1700 Presbury with Officer Miller. That's the other big discrepancy with CAD number 685, the location. There's not a single reference to 1700 Presbury on this report or any of the others in BPD's files. This address is one that the bike cops repeat over and over again on the audio, starting at approximately 8:41, a solid 30 seconds before Rice's backup call to 1707 North Mount. It's also the address they give when requesting a transport van.
1700 Presbury, let's get a wagon.
91's on the way.
But according to the dispatch records for that morning, there was no police activity on the 1700 block of Presbury. None at all. Moving on. One of the key benchmarks on the audio is when Goodson tells the dispatcher that he's leaving stop one.
1 mile from 1700 Presbury to Western District.
10-4.
Again, not only is there no reference to Presbury Street on CAD 685, but there's also nothing about Goodson going to Western District. And let's be very clear here. When a wagon driver tells dispatch that they are transporting a prisoner somewhere, the time, the destination, and the number of prisoners is noted on the CAD report. And we actually can see that for ourselves on CAD 685, but at 8:54 and 32 seconds. That's when Goodson's location changed to central booking, and he indicated he had one prisoner. So it's like Goodson was going to CBIF from stop one, but around the time he left stop two, according to the official timeline. And wait, who's the prisoner? "There's no arrest," Mary basically shouted this at me. "According to your official documents, BPD, you've got someone in custody who's being sent to jail for processing, but no one knows what for." So CAD reports are all given an incident type, like larceny, robbery unarmed, family disturbance, narcotics outside, narcotics inside, etc. Some of the incident types are more vague and sound like they could be sort of interchangeable, like foot patrol and detail, for example. Detail is the incident type on the CAD reports for stop 1, stop 2, and stop 5 in BPD's case files. I did a little research, and foot patrol is generally used to describe an individual officer walking around their assigned post. Detail, on the other hand, refers to an officer or officers who have been given a specific assignment. Also, detail calls are conveniently omitted from Open Baltimore's list of 911 calls. The CAD numbers still exist, though, and despite BPD's attempts to hide them, they're still considered public information. Here's another strange thing that's important to mention. At no point on the audio or in the CAD reports does Goodson indicate the transport van's mileage. I've listened to a lot of the police scanner at this point, and this seems to be pretty standard for BPD, both back in 2015 and now. Whenever a van driver is transporting a prisoner to the district, to CBIF, or to the courthouse for an appearance, the driver tells dispatch their mileage at the start and end of the trip. Mileage is also reflected on the CAD reports, either with the exact numbers or a note that reads mileage on tape, indicating that the specifics can be heard on the audio itself. According to a BPD general order, giving dispatch the mileage is only required when transporting a prisoner of the opposite sex. Nevertheless, most van drivers seem to do this regardless, so while Goodson may not have been in violation of policy, it's just still odd. CAD 695 is another report in BPD's binders and can be clearly associated with stop 2 in terms of location and to a lesser degree the timing. So located at North Mountain Baker, CAD 695 was initiated at 8:49 and 56 seconds, and Officer Nero, having cleared 1707 North Mount Street, is listed as the primary officer. But as you'll recall, according to the dispatch audio, stop 2 was actually initiated by Officer Miller over 3.5 minutes earlier. Remember how we asked Goodson to stop at the end of Gilmore Homes so we could toe tag Freddie because the bike cops decided to stay out? Well, Miller is not on CAD 695, and neither is Goodson, who, according to CAD 685, is still back at stop 1 until his location changes to CBIF at around 8:54. The only backup officer at stop 2, according to CAD 695, is Officer Novak. This is interesting because according to the audio, of all the officers who responded to stop 2, Novak is the only one who didn't tell dispatch he was coming. And remember how he even took that sneaky route? Meanwhile, the officers who did tell dispatch they were on their way, that's Officers Porter, Jackson, and Wood, they're not listed as backup officers at stop 2. According to their unit reports, Porter hadn't even responded to any calls yet, and Jackson and Wood were both on calls in other sectors. Obviously, I don't trust the CCTV footage to be an accurate depiction of anything, but I do trust Brandon Ross's video from stop 2, and that for certain shows Porter and Jackson at least were there. But the dispatch records suggest they are much quieter about their comings and goings than the audio makes it seem. CAD 695 is affiliated with the original case number or CC number, which we've talked a bunch about on this episode. It was given to Miller on the dispatch audio. But according to the report, it was given to Novak at 8:52 and 27 seconds. By the way, for those of you who are playing our Novak shows up somewhere he's not supposed to be doing something shady drinking game, feel free to take a shot. But please note, it's not clear what the original CC number was for. There's no actual offense noted on the CAD report, let alone the concealed deadly weapons that Miller told dispatch about. Most of the CAD reports I got via MPIA requests have proven pretty useful, but one in particular immediately had me saying, holy shit, holy shit. CAD 698 was initiated at 8:52 a.m. on the 1700 block of Pressman Street, according to Open Baltimore. So, towards the end of stop 2, just one block away from Gilmore Homes. The description or incident type is the most vague one of all, other. I'd noticed the call in Open Baltimore forever ago, and its proximity to Gilmore Homes and the timing made me really curious. Then I saw multiple examples throughout BPD's files where Prestman Street was mistaken for Presbury Street. Miller, for example, got them confused in his interview with detectives, and Gladhill put 1700 Pressman on his run sheet. Maybe this call is somehow related to Freddie, I thought. Bingo! The only officer associated with CAD 698 is Garrett Miller. He initiated the call with dispatch at 8:52 and 22 seconds a.m. That's less than 10 seconds before Novak was given the original CC number at Mountain Baker Streets. Miller is tied to CAD 698 for nearly 12 hours. The call isn't closed until 8:42 p.m. According to Miller's unit report, 1700 Pressman was the only call he was on all day. This CAD report offers an account of his activity during that 12-hour time period. So it's already really strange that Miller is initiating an entirely separate call with dispatch during the same time period as Nero and Novak. I mean, they're all together. An incident can have multiple CADs, but dispatch usually links them to each other. And it's very hard to believe that this could be attributed to dispatcher confusion or crossed wires, because the same dispatcher was working both calls. By the way, as far as I know, the Western District dispatcher who handled nearly every transmission related to Freddie was never interviewed by investigators or the state's attorney's office. I think I know who she is, and I've done my best to locate her, but I haven't had any luck. I can't just call her at PPD either. See, after 25 years with the department, she's no longer working there. Maybe she retired? Anyway, back to my holy shit moment. So, at 8:54:03, two words were added by text to Miller's CAD 698. Deadly weapons. But that's it. Unlike Novak on CAD 695, Miller did not request a case number that morning. And by 8:54 a.m., according to BPD's timeline, Goodson was already in the driver's seat of the van, and Freddie was already toe-tagged with some sort of charge. So whatever Miller was doing, it was being deliberately kept separate. Miller had no activity for the following 5 hours, then went to headquarters, followed by ECU. And then, just after 8:42 p.m. that night, Miller requested and received a CC number for CAD 698. A different Western District dispatcher was on duty at that point, and Miller was given an entirely different CC number than the one heard on the audio and seen on CAD 695. He was given a CC number that does not appear anywhere in the binders and has never been associated with this case. So, what we have here are two different CAD numbers associated with two different CC numbers for a single arrestee. CAD reports are sequential and timestamped. By the end of stop two, Novak and Miller were squatting on two of them and giving themselves options. They had not decided what to charge Freddie Gray with just yet. And get this, at the same time as he was getting a CC number that night, Miller keyed in another somewhat cryptic note to CAD 698. It's got a couple typos, but I'll correct those for him. B09 advised to keep them separate and no further inform. B09 is Baker 09, also known as Lieutenant Rice. Keep what separate, LT? And that's just half the bombshell. See, in combination, CADs 695 and 698 offer really pretty solid proof of something we've been suspicious of for a very long time. The dispatch audio entered into evidence at trial was edited and is not a fair and accurate depiction of what occurred on April 12, 2015, at least as far as the request for a case number is concerned. Let's listen to that audio first.
33. Okay, 33. Incident 1020 now.
It's a good one. I mean, it doesn't turn off quite good.
Okay, 32. The number is 150-404-754. Okay, your CAD number is 20695.
Miller, or 33, did not request a CC number for concealed deadly weapons at 1700 Presbury on the morning of April 12th. And even when he did request a case number that night, stating the address correctly, I think it's safe to surmise, the dispatcher was not the same one working that morning and did not respond with the CC given to Novak. Put very simply, what we hear on the dispatch audio is Miller's nighttime request edited together with the morning dispatcher's response to Officer Novak. I've always wondered why the dispatcher on the audio called Miller 32. I finally understand why.
Thank you.
some of our heftiest doubts have lingered around the validity of stops 3 and 4 on the official timeline. According to BPD, investigators didn't even know about stop 3 until late in the investigation. Officer Goodson didn't alert dispatch that he was pulling over at the corner of Fremont and Mosher Streets, and since he didn't give a statement, they only learned about the stop after stumbling upon some footage from a corner store surveillance camera. That footage, of course, doesn't have a date or a timestamp, and the officer and transport van could be anyone. So it should come as no surprise that there's nothing for stop 3 on any of the CAD reports. The CCTV footage that is supposed to corroborate stop 4 at Druid Hill Avenue and Dolphin Street wasn't very convincing either. But there is other evidence of the stop. Officer Porter gave his account in his statement to investigators and in his trial testimonies, of course. And then there's the dispatch audio.
91. Yes, ma'am. Can I have a unit 10 by me, Druid Hill and Dolphin? I need to check this prison out.
Let me have a unit, Druid Hill and Dolphin.
10-4.
Okay, so stop 4 is documented on a CAD. CAD 685, the call that originated at 1707 North Mount. A little earlier, I told you that at 8:54:32, Goodson changed his location to central booking. It's not unusual to see this kind of activity on a CAD report, change location, especially for van drivers who are transporting prisoners. Though, as I mentioned before, this typically includes more information. At 9 a.m. and 36 seconds, Goodson's location changed again to Druid Hill and Dolphin, and there's a note which reads, checking out prisoner. 8 seconds later, Porter is listed on CAD 685, but only as a backup officer for Goodson at stop 4. Now, stop 4 may be documented as a location on CAD 685, but I'm still not convinced. If the officers were already in cover-your-ass mode by the end of stop 2, everything that comes after is even more suspicious, if you ask me. And clearly, they were thinking quick. The CAD report for stop 5 is number 714. It's actually the most normal of the bunch, although Porter arrives on scene a full minute earlier than he does according to the CCTV timing. But the strangest thing about it is that it isn't linked to Dante Allen. Even though Allen was never officially arrested, late that afternoon, Nero filled out an incident report, complete with a case number and a CAD number, but not CAD 714. Nero was attached to Stop 5's CAD for almost the rest of the day. At 2:13 p.m., his location changed to headquarters, where he was presumably interviewed by detectives. And then just before 5 p.m., Nero cleared CAD 714. Less than a minute later, he radioed dispatch to say he needed a case number for a narcotics outside at 1600 West North Avenue. Because he was no longer attached to a CAD number, this request generated a new one, CAD 801. Both the new CAD number and the CC number are on Allen's police report, as well as the ECU receipt for the drugs that were allegedly found on him that morning. Here's another weird thing. The police report, filled out by Nero, and the ECU receipt, filled out by Miller, they both list Allen's address as 1616 Stevens Street. This is not the address that Allen gave to detectives during his interview later that day. It's also not his address on any of his previous court records. In fact, this address doesn't exist. There is no 1616 Stevens Street in Baltimore. There is, however, a 1616 St. Stevens Street. But Dante Allen has never lived there. Did they just pluck this address from thin air? The discrepancies and weirdnesses across the dispatch activity go on and on and on. This episode is not long enough to list them all, but here are a few more I just can't leave out. According to the sign-in sheet down at headquarters, Goodson and the bike cops arrive for their interviews at 12:45 p.m. But according to the dispatch records, Rice, Nero, and Miller didn't go to headquarters until approximately 2:10. That's after Rice was supposedly interviewed by detectives. In fact, there is actual dispatch activity from Rice occurring during his alleged interview time frame. What the fuck? Here's another weird thing. Alvarado, Wood, and Gladhill all went to get gas between 9:45 and 10:20, which seems like a very weird thing to do when the district is already short-staffed and suddenly has a dying prisoner to deal with. Here's one last thing. There were two other arrests in the Western District on April 12th, but it's never been entirely clear how they were transported. The CAD reports indicate Wood handled transporting one prisoner, while Eugene Breen, another officer in the Western, handled the other. But it's not clear what vehicle they used, and the officers' run sheets indicate they only drove their respective patrol cars. Then I was clicking through the photos taken by the crime lab up on Presbury Street at around 1 p.m. that afternoon, and I noticed something. In the distance, there was a police van parked one block east of Gilmore Homes, with two familiar-seeming officers walking away from it. I zoomed in. It was Wood and Breen. So I zoomed in even closer, honing in on the van's license plate. The pictures are really high res. And it wasn't just any police van. It was the police van. The crime scene. At the scene where the crime began. As if nothing had happened at all.
The discussion around reforming police is heated, and it often feels intractable. Policing is shrouded in mystery, and police officers are incredibly protective of their own, to the point that they are reactionary towards suggestions from without. The recent DOJ report on Baltimore policing and the resulting consent decree have been met with resistance by BPD rank and file, not just the Fraternal Order of Police. They perceive it as punitive of decent cops, and lacking any focus on fighting crime. In fact, they perceive it as sacrificing tools that they need, like proactive enforcement that would help them fight Baltimore's soaring out-of-control homicide rate. On the other side, activists cannot fathom giving police more power or freedom. There's a third voice in the mix. Some of the strongest critiques of the way policing operates in this country come from retired officers who spent their adult lives entrenched in it. In 2002, an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, was created to organize cops speaking out against the drug war and/or fighting for reform. LEAP's executive director, Neil Franklin, is a retired Maryland and Baltimore police major and a Baltimore native. He remembers policing before the war on drugs.
In the 60s, some things that were rather different and unique as relates to the neighborhoods and policing is, number one, there were plenty of things for young people to do. Rec centers, just about every elementary school had a rec center. The police would visit those rec centers, and it wasn't part of a program. I mean, it was just something that the cops did. In the neighborhood that I grew up in, we knew the police. We really knew the police, not just their names, but spent time actually talking with them about different things from time to time. And, you know, when we were out sitting on our favorite corner, which all young people have, we have our favorite spot, and the police would come down the street, you know, we wouldn't hop up and begin to leave or run or anything. We would actually walk over to the car because we knew they were going to stop and talk. There was no fear. There was no apprehension because there was this a different attitude among the police, at least the ones that were in our neighborhood.
Franklin's colleague in LEAP, Rafer Davis, is a former officer from North Charleston, South Carolina. He describes how the war on drugs focus on public health is inappropriate and can backfire.
You know, they're trying to do diversion control with things like oxycodone. And so, you know, they're tightening it up on these pill mill doctors or whatever, but they've really tightened down with pharmacists on the amounts that they can prescribe a single person. They require a person to go every 30 days in person to go back to their doctor to get a prescription for their medication, which that's very burdensome, especially on people that are like sick and stuff.
Yeah.
And that has driven the price up and the availability of the oxycodone. And that makes heroin cheaper.
Police reformers like Davis and Franklin describe the need to transform police culture from a warrior to a guardian mindset.
It's a militarized culture. You have that militarized mindset. You know, your trained kind of mentality of, you know, go. It's almost like you're storming Normandy Beach. You know, there's the bad guys. Go out there and keep moving forward. The bad guys are in front of you. The fate of the free world depends on your steadfastness. And so you bring that same type of aggressive mindset into the policing. And that's part of what has contributed to where we're at today.
Dialectical theory takes two apparent opposites and looks at their interdependence, as well as looking at the underlying system that created both and their interrelationship. The tension between the crime fighters and the reformers is a product of underlying social and racial structures that some officers would like to change. in a memoir called You Can't Stop Murder. Retired police officer Stephen Tabling describes when cops shifted from carrying a .36 caliber and a nightstick to militarized gear, weaponry, and attitudes. He writes, "I'm not the first cop to take a swipe at the war on drugs. Privately, I know many of my fellow retirees have doubts about it. The concept of war is an idea that pushed the philosophy of policing off the path of investigation and enforcement and onto the road of fighting."
In August of 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a speech entitled, "Where Do We Go From Here?" The question also appeared in the title of his book, "Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community?" In the speech and the book, he expresses a concern about moving beyond the legislative victories of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and to think about how poverty kept African Americans and people around the world in a perpetual state of bondage. "Where do we go from here?" King asked. And then he advised, "We must first honestly recognize where we are now." He asked again, "Where do we go from here? First, we must massively assert our dignity and worth. We must omit a system that still oppresses us and develop an unassailable and majestic sense of values. We must no longer be ashamed of being Black." Versions of King's questions and his solutions have been uttered and recited in corners of Baltimore since Freddie's death, since the uprising, and since the trials of the police officers. Where did Baltimore go after Freddie Gray? Renewed attention on Freddie's Sandtown Winchester neighborhood attracted an array of programs and initiatives. In late April of 2015, the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP announced that they would open a satellite office in Sandtown to offer legal advice and register voters. On May 11th, the NAACP organized a canvass of Sandtown, in which dozens of volunteers knocked on doors and talked to residents about police misconduct complaints. In May 2015, Erica Alston founded the Kids Safe Zone at the Penn North Community Center. It's a youth center where kids can take classes, use computers, go on field trips, meditate, and play. After the heightened news coverage about the Kids Safe Zone, the center has been able to expand its footprint from the original site, a 1,000-square-foot abandoned laundromat, to a 5,000-square-foot space. 6 months after opening the doors, singer Alicia Keys paid a surprise visit to the Kids Safe Zone, and since then, donations have poured into the Safe Zone from foundations, private donors, and people inside and outside of Baltimore. Alston reported that patients at a nearby community drug rehabilitation center donated money to the Safe Zone kids so they could go to the pool. In January 2016, plans for an innovation village were announced on the corners of North and Pennsylvania Avenues, not far from the CVS that was targeted during the uprising. It would reopen a few months later in March. The innovation village is a plan to turn 7 square miles into a retail, housing, and technology hub in West Baltimore. Modeled after innovation villages in other cities, it promises good jobs, access to internet, and revitalization of communities ignored and neglected for years. Concerned neighbors are hoping that innovation doesn't simply mean gentrification. In September of 2016, the Baltimore City Health Commissioner announced that a $5 million grant would come to Central West Baltimore to, quote, "reduce the impact of trauma and build resilience." 13 West Baltimore schools would receive support from a $2.3 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education to address emotional and social needs and to pay for a full-time counselor at each school, including Matthew A. Henson Elementary, a school Freddie attended as a child. On April 12, 2016, West Baltimore celebrated the opening of Tubman House, a formerly abandoned row house turned community center, named after Harriet Tubman, who was born in Dorchester County, Maryland, and escaped from slavery in 1849, then led hundreds of runaway slaves to freedom. Tubman House sits across the street from the mural of Freddie on the corners of Presbury and North Mount, and was made possible by Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, the American Friends Service Committee, Friend of a Friend Organization, and Communities United. The house, which has essentially been occupied by organizers, offers classes for children, community food resources, and a meeting point for protesters and neighbors. In December of 2016, Governor Larry Hogan announced Project CORE, or Creating Opportunities for Renewal and Enterprise. The state pledged $75 million, and the city will pitch in $18.5 million to, quote, demolish as many city blocks of blight as possible. The way this will work in Baltimore is that the City Department of Housing will propose which properties should be demolished to the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. If they approve it, the property will be destroyed, seeded, and fenced in. Then the state will spend an estimated $600 million in housing and community development funds to encourage reinvestment. Some of that new development will be done by the participants in the CORE project's proposed workforce development arm. This used to be called slum clearance in the early 20th century, and these types of clearances funneled African Americans and other communities of color into public housing, eroded neighborhoods, and opened the door to private development. Hopefully, this time will be different. If you use history as an indicator, these programs will make some change, but not enough. But time will tell how Baltimore atones for its past injustices, and how Freddie will be remembered and honored in the future. King concluded his Where Do We Go From Here speech with one of his most quoted lines. Let us realize that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. For some in Baltimore, this is questionable. But perhaps King's final words can inspire those committed to Baltimore and its most victimized citizens. This is our hope for the future, King said. And with this faith,
we will be able to sing in some not too distant tomorrow with a cosmic past tense. We have overcome. We have overcome. Deep in my heart, I did believe we would overcome.
There is no doubt that the Baltimore Police Department fudged documents, the timeline, probably the CCTV footage, and definitely the dispatch audio related to the detention and death of Freddie Gray. Yet, sometimes incompetence, laziness, and generally terrible work ethic can lead to discrepancies in case documentation, but none of that can account for deliberately edited audio that misrepresents what actually happened. In this case, Baltimore police seems to have gone to some lengths to make sure no one ever finds out what really happened. And it worked because not a single officer involved in the killing of Freddie Gray was convicted of anything. But we at Undisclosed believe that justice starts with the truth, which is why we brought this story to you. The truth that Freddie Gray was detained and arrested for no reason and that he died through no fault of his own. The truth that in Baltimore, there have been many Freddie Grays, and unless something drastic changes, there will be more. The truth that the media rarely knows or tells the full story, and institutions of power always protect their own. On behalf of Amelia, Justine, Marsha, and myself, we thank you for taking this journey through Freddie Gray's last days, his last moments with us. Now, Undisclosed is in the business of digging for the truth where many hands have tried to hide it. And soon we'll be back with an investigation by Susan Simpson into a story filled with lies, decades of secrets, and a murder that the wrong person paid for. Next time on Undisclosed.
Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 16, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald-Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marsha Shatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode, Meethal Telhan produced, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. Our great sponsors this week were WAG and Audible. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag FreddieGray and or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson. I am incredibly grateful for the hard work that Amelia, Justine, Marsha, Rebecca, Rabia, Hannah, and Methil have put into making these past 16 episodes. They truly made something special, and I'm indebted to the team for letting me be a part of it. I look forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then...